Thanks a lot for the introduction, and I'll just take a second here to acknowledge my co-authors, Pete Kleinman, Lou Saporito, Gordon Fulmer, Ray Bryant, all from the Pasture Lab at University Park, Pennsylvania, and then Jasmine Lamba, who was a postdoc with our lab for several years, has moved on to a faculty position at Auburn University. So this session is all about legacy phosphorus, and I think as we're all well aware, legacy phosphorus is a really big problem globally, and it's just due to kind of historical management, applying phosphorus to soils routinely, and building up these pools of phosphorus, and there are many examples globally of where we've built these up to a great extent. If you look to the U.S. coastal regions on the West Coast, East Coast, the example is in Brazil, in Western Europe, and in Eastern China. And so there's a lot of interest. No doubt this session is solely focused on ways of tracking legacy pools of P, moving in streams, moving in runoff. And so there's, you know, kind of a heightened interest in trying to figure out, well, how do we find out how much of this is contributing to phosphorus and runoff? And I've had experience using tracers in kind of a past life. I've used rare earth elements to track phosphorus. I've used stable isotopes to track nitrogen. And so there's a lot of excitement around tracers, and you've probably seen some talks discussing tracers in this session, particularly the isotopic tracers of dissolved P, so oxygen-18 and phosphate is really big. There's quite a number of review papers coming out showing its potential for tracking dissolved P, and perhaps from legacy P sources. And also, radionuclide tracers, fallout radionuclides of particular P, and there are some talks in this session that will address ways of using these tracers to infer the sediment-bound phosphorus transport in streams and in runoff. But what happens if you don't have access to those kinds of tools? You know, not everybody can use fallout radionuclides. Not everybody has access to stable isotope, and the capability of sending samples out or looking at them. And so there's like kind of imploring for some simplicity sometimes. You know, basically, if you don't have these kinds of tools, you know, are there other ways out there that you can infer, you know, a legacy P versus an incidental phosphorus source. And so there are simple methods out there that can be used, and kind of with this in mind, I thought, you know, it might be useful just to review just field plot and column leaching studies that we've done where we've made these very simple assumptions to differentiate legacy P sources in runoff from those that are either from manure or fertilizer source. So those would be the incidental losses. How would you actually make this separation, you know, without the use of, you know, tracers or other things? And so there's two case studies that I'll present. One is the Mattern runoff study that we did back in the early 2000s. Mattern is a subcatchment of W38, and that's located here, the Ridge and Valley region of the Chesapeake Bay watershed. This is a close-up of W38, and here's Mattern. It's an 11-hectare, mostly agricultural catchment where we did some hill slope runoff studies looking at overland flow transport of nutrients. And so when you look at Mattern, you see we basically had runoff plots, paired runoff plots of three different landscape positions that are shown here. This is the foot slope region where we had nearly three sulfur concentration, about 78 milligrams per kilogram. That's just about agronomic optimum. And then these fields here in this lower landscape position were essentially fallow, didn't receive nutrients during the time of the study, so there's no fertilizer or manure supplied. You can contrast that then moving up slope. With the mid-slope position, where sulfur concentrations were a little bit higher, 144 parts per million, and then the seepage slope had the highest at 177. And these fields here did receive manure and fertilizer applications, you know, and were grown, they had corn and soybean rotations grown on them during the time of the study. And so we took kind of the average concentration of dissolved phosphorus in runoff over the course of the study. This is a natural rainfall runoff kind of study. So basically these plots were just exposed to natural rain events, and we're collecting runoff, and we were measuring the phosphorus concentrations in runoff after every event. So just took the means and plotted them. You can see that, you know, no surprise that, you know, the higher the soil phosphorus concentration, you know, at each landscape position, it corresponded with higher dissolved P in runoff. So no surprise there. And we know this from a lot of prior work. You know, Pete Bottas did a kind of a meta-analysis, basically of 17 different runoff studies that were done all over the country. A lot of them were runoff box studies, and show a real nice relationship between, you know, the Mallet 3 P content in soils and the amount of dissolved phosphorus you get in runoff. And so it's a real tight relationship. We know that the, you know, higher Mallet 3 P concentration in soils correspond with higher dissolved P losses in runoff. And you can see the slope of that line here. So when we kind of compare what we saw, you know, and, you know, this first kind of cut analysis on, you know, the MATTER study, and compared it against what, you know, PFAS, you know, was able to show, you know, our slope was quite a bit higher, and that's because, you know, these storms that we were analyzing, they included both incidental and legacy P losses, kind of built into this relationship. And so, you know, we thought, well, we got to try to, what if there's a way to factor out the incidental losses to get, you know, something that better approximates just the soil P controls on phosphorus and runoff. And so, using detailed management data that we had access to for all these different landscape positions, we basically just made a simple assumption saying that, you know, here's kind of the non-growing season, you know, periods where we feel this is kind of the background soil P loss, and then here we have manure fertilizer being applied, and that these spikes, basically, in phosphorus that you get in runoff represent the incidental P transfers due to manure and fertilizer that have been applied. And if you factor those out, you can make an inference, you know, that these are this 1.2 milligrams per liter represents kind of the soil P control, the amount of phosphorus that's being contributed from the soil. And we can do this at all three landscape positions. And then with our runoff data, we're able to, you know, replot that relationship, and it shows that you can get pretty close to, you know, what Pete was able to observe just looking at soil P controls and runoff boxes and field plot studies. And we take that information and apply it to our, you know, overland flow data, and we can kind of parse out basically the contributions from legacy P and incidental P. So the two upslope landscape positions show an influence of the incidental P transfers. Those are the fields that were receiving routine fertilizer manure applications. Whereas in the lower landscape position, it's largely soil P controlled, and so you have quite a bit more contribution from legacy P. And then the trends that you see in total P loss basically follow the runoff trend. So much higher runoff, you know, volumes in these lower landscape positions produces much larger losses of P closer to stream. So we can contrast that against a leaching study that Pete Kleinman led on the Delmarva Peninsula. And I'm just going to focus on, he collected soils, him and his team collected soils up and down the Delmarva. I'm just going to focus on two soils just for simplicity. These come from Somerset County in Maryland. And these are some of the highest peat content soils on the eastern shore, 350 to 400 part per million soils. And basically collected soil columns to do a column leaching study. So these columns were 30 centimeters in diameter, 50 centimeters deep. They were replicated and basically, it's a laboratory study. So the two conditions I'm going to look at are just it's a conductive soil, which is pretty close to the University of Maryland Eastern Shore in Somerset County. There's a low P and a high P condition. This just shows the P concentrations with depth in the low P soil, so maybe 70 parts per million at the surface and trending downward to just under a couple parts, above a couple parts per million, 50 centimeters. And there's the high P soil, which well over 600 parts per million at the surface, so much higher soil P concentrations in these two soils. This just shows a photo of kind of the setup for the column leaching study that they conducted. And so if you look at the background losses, this they basically leached these columns for a period of 8 weeks. This is kind of the background P losses that you get in these columns prior to any manure application. You can see that the high P soil, not surprisingly, had much higher P losses than the low P soil. And then they applied 52 kilograms of phosphorus per hectare. That's the rate that they applied to the columns after the 8th week. And then you can see the trends that follow afterwards. You can see this very large spike in P loss here from a low P soil, interestingly, much higher than what you got from a high P soil. And then they start to trend back downward towards kind of background leaching conditions as you move onward in the study. And so you can make an assumption, you know, that after the first 8 weeks, that 8th week kind of represents the equilibrium soil P loss from these columns. And then you can essentially just take that value, if you wanted to, and subtract it from, you know, the next eight weeks, 9 through 16. And if you do that, you can make an inference about, you know, what's the incidental P loss. So this just shows the weekly P losses for the incidental transfers from both of those two soils. And then by difference, you can kind of intuit, you know, what's coming from the legacy P sources or what's coming from soils. And so it's just very simple kind of assumptions here. And when you plot that out, you can essentially see that, firstly, you get greater P losses from the high P soil than from the low P soil. But notably, the high P soil has a much greater fraction of legacy P losses. It's got a lot higher P stored on the surface. And it's contributing quite a bit more to legacy P losses. You can make a very simple kind of calculation here for both those two soils. It's kind of another approach of getting at these kinds of losses. So to summarize, simple approaches to distinguishing legacy P sources. These have been trialed. We've trialed them quite a bit in our lab, and they have a lot of merit. And applying these methods, if you're using runoff data, requires sufficient management data, you know, detailed management data and monitoring rigor to kind of justify your assumptions. But it'll be really interesting, given the focus of the session on tracers, to perhaps pair these kinds of approaches together to either test their agreement to see whether they concur or whether there's any disparity, and perhaps the tracers can tell you quite a bit about where or what pools of P are active. I mean, we can't get at that kind of information from very simple assumptions we're making, but so that's where the tracers would have value, and pairing these approaches would be pretty useful. So thank you for your time and attention. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Yes, we do have time for questions.
Well, there could be, there could be some effects even just within the columns themselves. MapReport flow can transmit some of that instant LP losses pretty rapidly. So, and Pete could maybe speak to that, why the losses are so the incidental losses are so much greater in the low P columns, but it could be a MapReport.